the next case. You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman, representing Deontay Payne. Aaron Ashwell and Aaron Houchins are with me at counsel's table, as is Marvin Miller, who is the author of one of our amicus briefs for the VACDL. The central dilemma posed by this case is that juries frequently accept eyewitness identifications as compelling and persuasive testimony, but science and history show that even confident eyewitnesses are often mistaken. This highlights the distinction between credibility and reliability that lies at the core of this case. The trial below involved a robbery in a laundry room. The prosecution argued in opening and closing that the victim, via his identification of the defendant, alone justified a conviction, and told the court at one point, quote, "This whole case is about the identification of the defendant." Given the admittedly prominent role of Villa's identification, Payne sought an eyewitness identification instruction, a variation of the Telfair-Holly instruction, which is at page 526 of the appendix. And the instruction was necessary because the evidence presented multiple factors that touched on the reliability of the identification.
May I ask you this? Does anything in the Constitution of the United States or Constitution of Virginia require, in all cases of eyewitness identification, proper instruction number one?
I would say, to the extent, if you're asking if we're bringing a Fifth Amendment type.
I'm just asking, is there a constitutional basis to require trial courts to use this instruction that you proffered in eyewitness identification in criminal cases?
We are not necessarily relying on that to go that far. At the same time, we recognize that Perry does say that this kind of instruction is a due process protection.
Are you asking us to hold that the Constitution required, in this case, proffered instruction number one to be given?
We are not going that far.
All right. Does any statute require it to be given?
Does any statute require that this instruction be given as a matter of law in every case?
In any case involving eyewitness, disputed eyewitness identification?
Well, there's the distinction. If you're asking about in any case, then we're not necessarily going that far out. But we are saying there are loads of cases that say that we're entitled to an instruction consistent with the theory of our case, and this was 100% consistent. This was a misidentification case. Basically, the other side.
I got that. It's not a constitutional right. It's not a statutory right. So it is the court's administration of its own theory of the case instruction doctrine. And the next question, as you might imagine, is given our precedent, what basis do we have for saying that? It would be entirely a novel and arguably proactive view of Virginia law.
No, sir, it really wouldn't, because we have, again, the very strong current in Virginia law that every case where the instruction is consistent with the defendant's theory of the case, you're entitled to an instruction. And you have Daniels, which basically got right up to the line and said, if you have a suspect police procedure, you might have this instruction.
Well, the court has the discretion to give it. It wouldn't be error to give it, in all likelihood.
I would disagree with that, again, because in Daniels, there was no suspect police procedure issue raised. The court specifically said that. We think that when our theory of the case, the first thing argued and the first thing argued by the other side, when both of them are saying, this is how is the identification is there a misidentification case, then the question is, well, is the evidence in the case relevant to that? And we did prove evidence, and let me tell you some of what it is, and then let me go forward.
Before you get there, let me follow up with Justice Kelsey. It may very well come under the idea of the judiciary's responsibility administratively to police, as it were, the trials of cases in the Commonwealth. Every trial judge, every appellate judge's nightmare is, and if it's not, it should be, that we have an innocent person in prison. IDs of criminal defendants have often been written about academically and otherwise, and some of us here on this bench have been trial judges and have seen it up close. It's not a constitutional question in this case, not as it's been presented to us. But it clearly would not be error to do it. The question is, and it probably would be error, or at least an abuse of discretion, to do it in every case. So why wouldn't your position be, it's not an instruction for every case, but it is an instruction for a case that fits this model. Now write the opinion. What's the model?
Well, that is, in fact, our position, and the model, I guess, would be, again, I'm sorry to repeat, but it begins and ends with every case where the instruction is consistent with the defense theory. Here, the defense theory, and adding on from Daniels, is there were suspect police procedures. I think for a good rule for the court, even though we're relying principally on the suspect police procedures, if there's no corroborating forensic evidence and there's an eyewitness identification, it would be helpful. As the Court of Appeals acknowledged in its opinion, there are 10 states, including New Jersey and Connecticut, who have great opinions on this, and Tennessee and Maryland, that say when the identification is central to the prosecution's case. Here, they argued in closing argument, the identifications were everything. He identified him 4 different times, and that's it. So, having said that...
Well, the number of identifications may not necessarily be dispositive because they tend to reinforce themselves.
So the
factors that are involved in the case, it seems to be, would be things like, is there an opportunity, an unusual opportunity for mistake because of an identified separate individual?
Correct.
Is there a cross-racial identification, which apparently there isn't in this case, but...
There is.
Well, I'm not sure that that's been demonstrated, but in any event, that would be a factor if it were. The recency of identifications, was it at the scene, for example, as opposed to in a lineup later? All of those kinds of things, it seemed to me, would be factors. List them out for me. What are they?
Well, in this case, you really do have a litany of the factors that the scientific articles
but I,
say.
I'm not so much concerned.
I understand.
I'm concerned about your case.
No question about it.
But I'm concerned about the thousands of other cases that are out there. Give me a principle.
Well, I think the principle can be the different categories I was just giving you. I mean, the main one is where it's consistent with our theory of the case that there's something wrong with the identification, which is what we are saying here.
So every contested identification case, every one, you have a right under some law to have this one instruction.
No, sir. You have a number of cases out there where that didn't happen. There has to be good evidence. Now, here... what's not disputed here...
I can't let you go on that because it's a crucial question. The issue is, if you were to win this case, what does it mean, not just for your case, but for all the cases in the Commonwealth? And if what it means is every single prosecution in which identity is disputed and in play, you have a right, reversible on appeal if it's not given, for your instruction as opposed to the instructions you paraphrased in your brief, and that there is per se error for not giving this instruction, that's a bold holding.
Well, we are not telling you that you have to reverse, you have to follow Daniel's. That's what we're saying. This is the case Daniel's was talking about. In this case, and there's a litany of things in our brief, but the main one is they used the same photo in the second lineup of Mr. Payne, even though they had others.
Judge to give an instruction that says that? If that were the case, your instruction didn't say anything about the police procedures or cross-racial or any of the things you're arguing on brief.
It said the circumstances of the identification, which allow us to argue with the support of the instruction that there were things wrong with the circumstances of the identification.
Okay. So, counsel, let me return to the Chief Justice's line of questions. So I think I heard three factors, that if there is suspect police procedures, no corroborating evidence, and a contested identification, then a Telfair instruction would be warranted, and that you are asking us to reverse based upon those three factors being present here.
Correct.
Let's spool it out.
I would say no corroborating forensic evidence, because somebody will always say, oh, maybe you didn't believe what the defendant said. But yes, with that one change. And
okay. Now let's spool it out. Then if we adopt that as a three-part test, then in the future, would it be an abuse of discretion for a different trial judge in a different case to reject a Telfair instruction when those three are present?
In part of the problem with the abuse of discretion issue now under Daniels is it's okay to never grant the instruction. If it's not going to be granted in this case, where you have suspect lineup procedures, a lot of time between the robbery and the lineup, imperfect lighting, a brief stressful encounter among people of different races, which was conceded below by the prosecution, and the presence of weapons, you're never going to grant this instruction in Virginia. This case has every relevant factor. To answer your question, I think in the future, the pivotal question will be whether the instruction is consistent with the defendant's theory of the case. If it is, then it is an error of law under Carey and all the cases that say you're entitled to an instruction consistent with your theory of the case, if you put on evidence to prove it. And a lot of the old cases, several of them death penalty cases with throwaway arguments, didn't prove it. So you don't have to change everything. You have to take the next step from Daniels.
So if we have those factors, it's no longer abuse of discretion under your analysis. It's a matter of law, and it'd be per se reversible error.
I'm saying when you prove all of those things, I think it would be prudent to make that rule of law, yes. But I don't think you have to. In this case, if you want to decide a case and say under these facts, but they're all here now. I mean, there were eight of them, and they're the classic ones, and they're all here. And this young man faced a life sentence.
If we were to rule for you, would our new rule be retroactive to the thousands of eyewitness cases that are capable of being presented by habeas corpus?
I don't believe it would. I think you'd be just going where Daniels told you you already were. It's just no one's gone there. Everyone says, oh, it's duplicative, or oh, it's discretionary. And it shouldn't be. Again, a life sentence based on nothing more than the credibility. And I will close because I would like to save a little of my time. What the Court of Appeals said is the credibility of Villa was covered in Instruction 1. Credibility, the problem at the core of this is
reliability.
It's reliability. That's exactly right. They believe what they're saying. They believe they're right. So it makes the credibility instruction actually counterproductive because they believe it, they're believable, but they're wrong. More than 81% of the time, I believe there's a study that says in Virginia, when there's a DNA reversal, there was an eyewitness identification.
You have 40 seconds left.
Good morning, ma'am. please the Court, Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. This case falls squarely under Daniels versus Commonwealth. The Court of Appeals did not overrule or limit that case. The identification actually in this case was better than it was in Daniel. All of the same instructions that were given in Daniel were given here, plus an additional one that wasn't in the model instructions at the time of Daniel's. Instruction number 4 was also given. The defendant had the protections, some of the protections that Perry versus New Hampshire mentioned, namely the effective assistance of his counsel who engaged in robust cross-examination and unfettered closing argument, as well as the proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the evidentiary rules, the right to confrontation, all of those things also mentioned in Perry versus New Hampshire as protections in the adversary system. I would make one point about...
Ms. Tyson, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Let me get right to the... Justice Kelsey is surely correct when he says that this instruction is not an instruction that would be given in every ID case. I mean, it's just not... It wouldn't be justified in every ID case. We have said over and over again, and I'm quoting, this happens to be from Stockton, but it's from many, many cases, when granted instructions fully and fairly cover a principle of law, a trial court does not abuse its discretion in refusing another instruction relating to the same legal principle.
Correct.
It seems to me that if you start with the premise that an instruction like this is not going to be given in every case, but there may be the case where the granted instructions that are there do not fully and fairly cover the issue. And what I'm saying is that this case presents legally not so much an expansion of Daniels as an explanation of Daniels. Because I think Daniels covers this case. But what does it mean when you say, when granted instructions fully and fairly cover a principle of law, the trial court does not abuse its discretion in refusing another instruction? Suppose it doesn't fully and fairly. Wouldn't there be room for a defendant to demonstrate when you have these things in the case, and lay them out? I'm not going to spend any time doing it, but it's in the briefs, and I know you've talked about it as well, that this instruction would be permissible, and it would be reviewable by, just as we said in the past, an abuse of discretion.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. And Daniels, in fact, is in that camp, if you will. There's the camp that says you, in some states, that say you always have to give it. There's a camp that says these are never permissible. And this court in Daniels put Virginia in the camp where it is a matter of discretion. And the trial judge was aware of that. Now, the instructions that were sufficient in this case, in order of importance, I think, were instruction number 4, number 1, and number 2. Instruction number 4, the one that was not in existence at least was not in the model at the time of Daniels, where the court actually instructed the jury that one of the disputed issues in the case was the identification of the defendant, and the Commonwealth had the burden to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, instruction number 1 that was given, which is the standard credibility of witness instruction, also has a couple of points in it that really bear upon reliability. The first one is the jury is instructed that it must consider the manner of the witness. Okay, that's credibility. The intelligence, perhaps that's credibility. But also that instruction says their opportunity for knowing the truth and having observed the things about which they testify. That goes to their reliability.
Sure, it does.
Also, the jury is told in this very instruction that they can use their common sense. So if there is brought out in the robust cross-examination some discussion of how far away parties were, how much time elapsed, or what kind of lighting there was, all of that is in this instruction with regard to common sense. The final instruction that Daniel discussed as well would be the burden of proof and presumption of innocence, that the Commonwealth has the burden to prove all of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And maybe that builds upon number four, with regard to the Commonwealth having the burden of proof to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the identification when it's in dispute. And the identification was in dispute here. I do think that it's important to note
Really, does part of Daniel deal with the same picture being in both lineups?
I don't believe that that is addressed specifically, Your Honor. I will address that from this case.
In fact, the Daniel instruction was somewhat more amorphous than this one. Significantly more amorphous.
Yes, sir. That is absolutely correct. And this court, in ruling in Daniel, said, again, because there's discretion, an appropriate identification instruction isn't barred. It actually could be given. But it's the court's discretion in whether it's appropriate in that case. With regard to the same photograph being used, Your Honor, I think it's very important that at the time of the first photographic array, the detective did not have a photograph of Booney, who, by the way, Payne was the one who suggested that Booney perhaps was the culprit. At the Perry Mason moment where the victim actually picked Payne out of the audience from the preliminary hearing, not from counsel table. Following that, at the request of the prosecution let's do a lineup and put Booney in there, there was another lineup that was done. This, I think, is very important. Booney's photograph was number two. These were done sequentially, one at a time. And when the victim saw that photograph, according to the testimony at trial, his response in looking at Booney was no. Simply no. Not I don't know, I'm not sure. That's the testimony that's in the record. Payne's photograph, and yes, it was the same photograph that was used in the first one, was photograph number five. And the victim, Mr. Villa, picked that photograph the second time.
But I assume their argument is if it's neither Booney nor Payne, obviously they would say no when they get to Booney, but they may say yes when they get to Payne because he was in the first lineup.
I realize that they're challenging the police procedures. It really was not the focus at trial, was the flawed police procedures. But they're at the trial level, prior to trial at a suppression hearing, the defense withdrew their objection to the first lineup. Their objection had been whether there were color photographs or black and white photographs. But the fact of the matter is, the first lineup is not really in dispute as to its integrity. I think their concern, at least as I understand it, is that after seeing the defendant live at the preliminary hearing in the audience and then seeing him again, that he kept seeing the same photograph. But the victim did pick him out in the first photograph, a photographic lineup as well. And you may notice in Daniels, in Daniels, there are several cases involved, and there's quite a variety of how well people did with photographic lineups, in-person lineups, etc. I think it's important in this case that while identification certainly is the most important factor of the case, it's not the only factor in the case. And I would be remiss, I think, if I didn't point out.
Well, you've got a pretty damning admission coming out of the jail.
Yes, sir. The jail telephone call in which the defendant is heard admitting that he was recognized in the audience at the preliminary hearing was arrested at the courthouse. And I realize now the defense is arguing that was sarcasm. I would note in the Court of Appeals that was referred to as youthful vernacular, common youthful vernacular. The fact of the matter is the jury did hear that that telephone call, and I think the word recognized is pretty much a universal word, and that's exactly what happened at the preliminary hearing. We also know that this defendant admitted that he was the one who posted the Craigslist ad, and of course he's the one who suggested an alternative suspect in Booney. And so this is not just identification. Furthermore, there's a dispute, I think, about the lighting that was in the laundry room, and I understand, and it's difficult for me. Normally, I have the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, but not here. It's in the light most favorable to the defendant, and I understand that. But we still have a number of pieces of evidence. No matter how you look at this evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, the laundry room was not dimly lit. There was a light out, and it was a little dimmer than the courtroom. But there was still, the lighting was not poor in this case. The police officer testified that way. In the light most favorable to the defendant, this was not.
But the defendant argued lighting.
I'm sorry?
The defendant argued lighting.
Yes, sir.
And the instruction doesn't say it was dimly lit. The instruction says you're allowed to consider the lighting as one of the factors.
Your Honor, the telfair instruction does talk about the factors surrounding, but I would say that instruction number one that was given, where that instruction tells the jury it may consider the opportunity for knowing the truth and having observed the things about which he testified, would cover whether there was good lighting or bad lighting. And the cross-examination in this case was very extensive. The closing argument was unobjected to. All of the factors that the defense argued to the jury, the prosecution did not jump in and try to stop him from doing that.
Okay, and just one other question. If the judge had granted this instruction, would the Commonwealth be arguing that it was abuse of discretion to grant it?
Well,
would the prosecution...
Since we can't appeal, I would be in a very unusual situation.
Let me rephrase that. Would the prosecution have been within... Would the prosecution have had had grounds to argue that it was abuse of discretion at the trial level? I understand you can't argue it here. That's not what I was asking.
I think that the more likely argument would have been that this is already covered by the other instructions, and so you don't need to give this instruction and object to it. I think the Commonwealth could have objected to it. I think that if the trial court had given it, it may fall in that area that Lawler says, where there's a scope or a band of things that the trial court...
It's hard to imagine a litigant telling a trial judge, if I could actually appeal what you're about to do against my wishes, if I could make an appeal in that instance, I would argue that no reasonable jurist could do what you did. Normally litigators don't make that argument to anybody.
That is correct. I think what the argument would be, we have sufficient instructions with 4-2-1.
Let me put Justice Mims' question in a different setting, which you could argue about. If a trial judge, with the given instructions in this case, the ones that were given, then had a defense lawyer in closing who was actually going down in closing the whole list of issues that are in the... at least the version of the Holly instruction that we have in front of us here. And the trial judge said, no, I'm sorry, you can't make that argument. Even the Commonwealth would agree that would be an abuse of discretion.
It would, because, well, first of all, the judge in this case already told the defense attorney that he could argue these things.
Right.
And
so
they are covered by these instructions.
That gets to this question, which I intend to ask the appellants, and you don't have rebuttal. That's why I'm asking you, to give you the opportunity. In an accomplice testimony, we have instructions that say you have to be cautious about an accomplice testimony. The question for the Commonwealth is, does this subject matter rise to the level, like accomplice testimony does, that it's so important that the allocation of responsibilities on the subject are now the court's responsibilities in instructions as opposed to counsel's responsibility in argument?
Yes, sir. My response to that would be twofold. And I know what this court said in Cooper, where this court said alibi is different. It's like insanity and alibi, the two things you've got to give notice of ahead of time, and it's an affirmative defense. And so we're not going to let the trial judge have discretion in alibi this case. This is not that situation, because this is just a regular defense. It's an element. We've already instructed the jury. It's an element that must be proved. With regard to accomplice testimony, that's based on the law. That is an instruction based on legal matters and case law that has come down. And that's why I think it's different than this. When we're looking at taking a legal instruction number one, and then putting facts to it, and including facts from either social science or this jury is how you must look at this evidence. It is definitely different. It's distinct from the accomplice testimony, where the concern is, jury, no matter what kind of common sense you have, this is the law, that we have a concern about uncorroborated accomplice testimony. So I think there is a distinction. It's different from Cooper, where discretion has been taken away. It's different from an accomplice instruction, which is a legal instruction not filled in with these other facts that can be argued, but not necessarily part of the instruction. We would urge this court to affirm.
All right. Thank you.
The credibility instruction, number one, simply doesn't cover things like stress, fear, and time lapse that were in our tendered instruction. It does not relate to honest mistake, sincere mistake, and it doesn't mention photo lineups. As to the photo lineup at page 81 and 342...
But does it have to? I think that's the point. So long as an instruction can be reasonably be interpreted to include capacity, which is reliability. You were blind. You couldn't see. How can you say that was the person? That's capacity. If it can reasonably be understood to address capacity, and a lawyer, it can address the jury on all of those things that are now in this federal instruction, why is that not a correct or at least a permissible allocation of responsibilities between the court's instructions and the lawyer's ability to argue?
Well, what all the cases say and what some of the studies show that have made this instruction work, and there are a lot of them, is that it's not capacity, because the normal person thinks, I'm pulling up a memory. So I'm like watching a video. And
all right, well, use reliability.
But it's not capacity.
Use reliability. That's your word. Use it.
Reliability goes down when you have stress, when you have a weapon.
That may be the case. That's my point. If you're allowed to make that argument to a jury on existing instructions, why does the court assume the responsibility to highlight these issues in instructions before the jury?
Well, as the court has said many times, when there's an instruction that allows you to... The court's argument isn't evidence. The lawyer's argument is not evidence. So what can you point to that says, yes, the circumstances...
Well, neither is an instruction evidence. That's the whole point. Whose responsibility is it to point out the issue? Is it the court's responsibility? Or if the court has instructions that are sufficient to let the lawyer make the argument based on what is the evidence, why isn't that permissible?
But it's not when the instruction is consistent with our theory of the case, and credibility is plainly insufficient, and that's what they keep saying, this is great, it's credibility.
But the instruction that was given was the opportunity for knowing the truth and observing the things about which they stated. That's not just credibility, that's obviously, was it dim lighting or not?
It's also intelligence. Does that mean that a smarter person is more believable?
You know what? At some point, common sense does play a pretty significant role, even to lawyers and judges.
And that's where my point comes in. Because what the studies show is that you show somebody a picture and you bolster. They aren't remembering the person that was there when they, for 5 seconds, saw a gun in their face. They see the picture, and then 6 months later, when they're given the same picture, the exact same one, and at pages 81 and 342, they didn't have to. They had a lot of other pictures. When they're finally, we brought in Booney. Well, they brought in Booney with the same picture he'd already found once. Now, I would just mention that not even Detective Saul believed the second lineup. She writes the email that I still don't think that's right. The night after the in-court identification, there is grievous. I mean, we've been talking not so much about all the police problems, but there are grievous police problems here. And if that's just a credibility instruction, we're fine. If I may, because the court mentioned it, and I don't want to let the phone call go, please do recall that on an instruction, we are getting the evidence in best light for us. He is exasperated. You can listen to it. He's just basically saying, as he said at JA 421 and 423, that I show up because they asked me to, and the next thing I know, I'm under arrest. He doesn't have a great vocabulary. He's saying, I'm sitting there. All of a sudden, he's whispering to the police, and they're pointing at me. He's exasperated, and in best light, thank you for letting me get that out.
I have one additional question, and it's a nagging concern. We've been talking about the psychological studies and things. One thing that the studies show is that juries really don't believe anyone in the courtroom other than the judge in terms of believing them fully, having faith in them. So in a case like this, the judge, by granting general instructions, gives both attorneys the opportunity to argue their evidence, their theories, their witnesses, etc. But when you have one instruction that very specifically zeroes in on four aspects, I've got some concern that is communicating to the jury, you know, those are the four that you really need to be focusing on. And that it in fact tilts the table somewhat toward the proponent of that instruction. So what is the response to that?
Well, what's very important about that point is that the question is, do you suggest an outcome? We were just talking, Justice Kelsey and I, about intelligence. I think that in our case, boy, Mr. Villa was probably came off more intelligent. Do you have a stake in the matter? Is also in number one. Well, gosh, you know, our guy does, so maybe they don't believe him. He has a life sentence hanging over his head, basically based on the credibility of Mr. Villa's comments. So I guess what I'm saying is that if you don't suggest an outcome, we do it all the time. In this case, at J517, you have an instruction that says because one of the alibi witnesses had a felony conviction, that affects her credibility. In number one, we have the intelligence, and what do you have at stake? It happens. And when you have 80%, when you have a glaring problem with, you said people believe the judge, they also believe the eyewitness. And they just don't know how often that eyewitness is not retaining correctly. And thank you for that.
Thank you for your arguments, both of you. Call the next case.